story I was telling when I was afraid that a bear was going to come out and attack me. That was an irrational fear, but a proper fear was that I was not adequately equipped for the journey that I was on. And so I needed to be careful and needed to be thoughtful about what I was doing to provide for some safety. So fear works that way, to where at times fear is a good thing, at times fear is a bad thing. Well, today's sermon is going to use another one of those words. And this word, though, that we're going to look at, and it's going to come late in the sermon. I don't even want you to try to guess it, because it's going to be our main application for the morning, and we'll get to that in due time. But this word can be, and most oftentimes, the word is seen as a bad thing. So I want us to explore whether or not it can be a good thing as we look at this incredible story of this city you probably, maybe, you've never heard of, Jabesh Gilead. All right? Jabesh Gilead is a critical city on the eastern side of the Promised Land. And you need to know their origin story. And so if you go back to Judges, I'm not going to tell you about how bad things were. Most of us at some point have either studied Judges or we've read Judges and we think, what is this doing in the Bible? It sounds like things are as bad as they would be on Sunday night television on 2020 or Dateline. It is a disaster. And in a more reverent sense, we talk about the repeated line in Judges about how everyone was doing what was right in their own eyes. And we talk about how they no longer cared about what God wanted. So I will just tell you that the tribe of Benjamin had done some bad things. This is not one of those things where, you know, it was a good thing and it could be interpreted. No, it was bad. This was a bad thing that the tribe of Benjamin had done. And so Israel wanted to go take care of this, attack them for it. And so Israel slaughters Benjamin terribly, and then they feel bad about it. Again, Judges is a mess if you haven't read these stories. And so they say, well, what are we going to do about these men that are left in Benjamin? They need some wives. They need to be able, we need to keep this tribe alive. And so they say, well, who didn't join us in the battle? And it was Jabesh Gilead. The men of Jabesh Gilead had not joined in punishing Benjamin for their sins and executing that justice against Benjamin. So they said, here's what we'll do. With the people that are left, we're going to go slaughter the Jabesh Gilead men, and we'll get 400 of their virgins to come marry the men that are left in Benjamin. So that is the origin story of Jabesh Gilead. It's a very, if you can't see here on the map on the east side, it's kind of east of the river there, Jordan River, kind of centrally located between the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee. So it's a critical passing through area from the east on into the west. And so that is the origin here of where we first hear, this is where we first hear about this city, and that's their context. Is that they probably don't have that great of a reputation because they didn't help with Benjamin, and now they've been punishing them, and now they've been intermarried here with them in this great slaughter that Israel did against them. I'm not sure how they would have felt about how much the rest of Israel wanted to help them after going through something like that. But what we know about Israel is that eventually Israel had all this chaos in the book of Judges, and so they needed somebody to rescue them. And so they ask Samuel, can we get a king to rescue us? And God actually gives Samuel permission to do a king, but he starts the speech off. He says, I was the one who rescued you out of Egypt, reminding them who their real rescuer is. Now, in some of your translations, the word might be deliverance instead, and that's okay. But just what you see throughout these stories is the repeated use of either deliverance or rescue. And so God reminds him, I'm the one who rescued you. And this king will not be able to rescue you, but I'll give you a king anyway. And so you probably remember the story of the first king of Israel. I remember from a very young time as a kid getting to do the coloring sheet, and you'd have these old luggage things, trunks, right, that you see sometimes used as end tables now in the family room. Nobody actually puts those on an airplane. They might put them on a train if they're trying to carry some drums somewhere. But there's this old huge trunk, and I would color in this little boy hiding behind it. Do you remember this story? When Samuel says there's going to be a king, they are shocked. Because the one who's going to be king is found hiding amongst the baggage. It's King Saul. And so something happens there too, is whenever Samuel says, this is the one, there were some bad guys in that moment here in chapter 10 of Samuel that says, is he the one who can rescue Israel? And it's kind of a fair question, because you want to king to deliver or rescue you, you don't want to choose a young boy who's hiding amongst the baggage. Now, Some of us may know some of the legends of some of the founding fathers of America. And we think about, oh no, the perfect kind of person for kingship is one who doesn't want it. Well, maybe, but that's a distraction really from what's going on here. So let's get back into ancient Israel and let's talk about their enemies. You remember, lots of us have heard of the Philistines in the west, the lesser known Ammonites in the east. They had a king. And he comes along and he begins to destroy and fight and go to war against all the tribes of Israel, all the people of Israel over on the east side, Reuben, Gad, and eastern Manasseh, I think it is. And so what he was known for is he would gouge out the right eye of these men. Because if you had your right eye cut out, you're not going to be as effective of a warrior. And so 7,000 men had retreated to Jabesh-Gilead. There's that city again. They've retreated to Jabesh-Gilead, and here's the scene that gets kind of weird, except for the fact that in pop culture, we see this all the time in the superhero movies. The bad guy, the king of the Ammonites, his name is Nahash, which means snake. So the snake king has got these 7,000 men retreated to Jabesh-Gilead, and they say to him, well, if you give us a week, maybe we can go get some help. And I don't know why this always happens in the stories, but the bad guy here is like, okay, sure. I don't know if he was just so arrogant that he thought, oh, you'll never be able to find anybody, or even whoever you get won't be able to take on me. Whatever the story is, he allows them to send messengers then out to Israel. And so the messengers go to start telling people, hey, Jabesh-Gilead has 1 week to get ready for this fight with the snake king. And that's where then Saul re-enters the picture. From being anointed in chapter 10, now we're in chapter 11, and here he is not looking like a king again. Again, you may be saying, well, no, I think that actually looks like a great king. Here's the problem with these Old Testament stories. We never get a New Testament interpretation of them. And so we read these stories, we wish we could know, how did Paul preach this story? I don't know, but this is my take on it. As he's coming in from the fields with his oxen, I don't see a king figure there, not one who is ready to take on and rescue Israel. He's coming in with the oxen, and he sees all these guys crying in the village, and he says, well, what are they crying about? And the messengers tell him, well, all the men have retreated to Jabesh-Gilead, and the snake king of the Ammonites has said he's going to kill them. And so he gave them a week to find some men. Now Saul begins to look like a king. And maybe he was always destined for this moment. Maybe he was already ready for this moment. Maybe he was ready to get back those guys who had once slandered him. But we'll see in a moment why I don't think that's the case. But here's what his reaction is to it. The Spirit of God comes on him, and he is angry. And in his anger, he slaughters the oxen into pieces and gives them to the messengers. And he says, you guys go out to all Israel and say, this is what's going to happen to them if they don't rally and help rescue Jabesh-Gilead. It's an incredible moment. I don't know what it would have been like in the ancient world to have these pieces. That's kind of what happened in Judges, if you know that story. But these pieces to have messengers come traveling through the land, coming to each village and showing you a piece of the animal and saying, the slaughter of this animal will be what you are treated like if you don't come rescue these people. And so it's an incredible moment. And 330,000 people of Israel come to the battle. So Jabesh-Gilead is encouraged by this, and they go tell the snake king. They said, okay, tomorrow you can do whatever you want with us. And the king comes out ready to take them, only to be slaughtered by the 330,000 of Israel. So I don't know if you noticed there in that moment here, this was an incredible moment that Saul has. We don't usually get to say, you usually don't have a whole lot of nice things you get to say about Saul. But here's a great moment in which the Spirit of God came on him, very much like what it did with the judges, and there can be some interpretation with that, but the Spirit comes on to him, and the product of this is anger. We'll come back to that in a moment. And so that's what rallies the troops to take care of this enemy of Israel. Now, there's one more good thing to say about Samuel. So look at verse 12 with me. In 1 Samuel chapter 11, verse 12, it says, then the people said to Samuel, who is he that said, shall Saul reign over us? Bring the men that we may put them to death. But Saul said, not a man shall be put to death this day, for today Yahweh has accomplished rescue in Israel. What a moment. He has just undoubtedly secured his moment here and the confidence of all Israel with this great moment of rallying the troops to rescue this city that really, in the minds of some, maybe didn't deserve rescue. And so they're now so loyal to him. Some men had already gone with Saul. If you read back in chapter 10, some of the men had gone home with him back whenever he was anointed. And so these men are now ready to say, let's go get rid of all the rest of your enemies. And he says, no one else is going to die today. It's an incredible moment of mercy from this king in which we usually don't have a lot of good things to say about him. Now, we're going to come back to that Jabesh-Gilead story in just a moment, but here's what I'm going to insert the application for today, the question for us to ask. Did you notice here, as I alluded to what happened here, the Spirit of God came on him, verse 6, mightily when he heard these words, and he became very angry. What does the Bible say about anger? And here again is why I'm scared about how this sermon could be misused and abused by people who have an anger problem. So let me be clear here as I get into this application here to say this. This is not a justification for you to be sinful in your anger. Because what Paul tells us in Ephesians is, be angry and do not sin. So what we want to talk about is, where is there any element, is there any element for healthy anger? One person, I think seriously, maybe jokingly or seriously said about this text, anger is one of the fruits of the Spirit. Did you catch that? Spirit came on him, anger came about. So you can you say anger is one of the fruit of the Spirit? Paul said if it is, it's low-hanging fruit whenever he emailed me about this sermon. But this is something I think we need to spend some time talking about because you'll notice this in Bible characters and people throughout history. And so the questions I want us to ask about anger is this. Anger can become sin depending upon what we are angry about. What if we are angry about sin? Maybe starting within ourselves. I think that can be a healthy anger. Say, I do not like the times where I give in to temptation and sin in ways that I know are wrong. There have been several Bible characters that get angry about things we ought to be angry about. And I know that this gets abused by some people, as I've already said. But yeah, the old thing that gets drug out every time, Jesus overturned the tables. He was angry about people who had misused God's house. And he is the Son of God, and he can have his anger in a way in which he does not sin. The question again for us is it the right thing we're angry about? And then how do we handle that anger? Have we been authorized to go into God's house and start throwing over tables the way Jesus was? I'm not convinced that we are. So we ought to be asking these questions to be able to try to have the full picture about anger. Proverb after proverb after proverb warns about how bad anger can be. From a position of anger, we can make very poor choices. Paul's letters are full of encouragement to have the actual fruit of the Spirit: love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Those aren't things that usually we associate with angry people. And over again, he's warning about what words come out of our mouth, and they are words that come from a place of anger, but the words are wrong because they're malice and slander. They're saying lies about others. They're spreading things that ought not be spread because in the first place, they aren't even true a lot of times. We've made assumptions about people. So anger can lead us down a lot of dark and bad paths. I think most of us have heard those sermons. This is a different kind of sermon. What are you going to be angry about, and how are you going to handle it? Paul was angry with Peter, who had become a hypocrite, so much so that he even led Barnabas into the same sin. Paul was angry once with Barnabas, and so they peacefully agreed to go separate directions. We're in that right now in the book of Acts. I don't read there in Acts 15 any sin that happened between them. Remember what we said in that class? You could say that some people were angry about what some of the people were teaching the Gentiles. You need to be circumcised to be a Christian. No, that's not right. And so they were angry about a false doctrine. How did they handle it? They sat down and peacefully talked it out with much debate. Paul gets angry with other people besides Peter and Barnabas. Paul gets angry with Alexander the coppersmith. I've always found it so interesting that, you know, he talks about Hymenaeus, or however you say that name. He doesn't tell us what that guy did, but he tells Alexander the coppersmith. I wonder what his reputation was in that region that Paul could write it that way. But he was angry with him. And if you're saying, well, that's, yeah, this, the common figure there is Paul, Paul, Paul. So is Paul a bad guy? Well, it's not just Paul. John is mad. And John, in his letters, he's angry that Diotrephes is not having fellowship with the saints because he says, I want to be a first place, and so I'll decide who's in and out of this church, not the apostles. And John says, you need to take care of Diotrephes and not let him run the show over there. So what are we angry about? And how do we handle it? If Saul hadn't gotten angry here, would Israel have been rescued? Would Jabesh-Gilead, the unwanted of Israel, been rescued? Because I'm sure part of what Saul understood there was, if we don't stop the snake king now, what's to stop him from crossing the Jordan River and coming after us? Sometimes it is easy in life, if somebody else is the one who's being picked on or mistreated or abused, to say, well, that's their problem. And never stop to step back and say, how might that eventually impact us? This last week, I finally did it. Jim Lees kept saying, you better stop walking around. You're going to trip up there. And he's not here to see it. This last week, America, on Monday, social media was so confusing, was for me at least. Everybody of every type was quoting Dr. Martin Luther King. From every different perspective of whatever it is you wanted, whether it was about the rights of African Americans in his time and racism that still goes on today, or whether it was about the freedom of speech or about his desire for education, it seemed like every person of every stripe of every religion and every political background was citing something about Martin Luther King. And then the thing that I always think about on that day is it's an act of service. And here's one weird thing is that everybody comes out on Martin Luther King Day to do service, but I didn't see any quotes about him speaking about service. I'm sure he did. I just don't know how it all of a sudden, I don't know the evolution of that day. I've never looked into it. But here's something I thought about as I was working on this lesson. He was angry about the mistreatment of his people. And if he hadn't been angry about his people being mistreated in that time, there never would have been an I Have a Dream speech. There never would have been this man for us to quote all over the place on social media for whichever cause it is we want to use his words to support our own cause. This man and this part of American history came because of anger. He was angry about something that we should be angry about, the mistreatment of someone because of the color of their skin. That's terrible. It's wrong. It's sinful. That's a good anger. How did he handle the anger? Nonviolent protest. And he got heat for that from some of his own people. The little bit I do know about his history is some of his own people said, that's never going to work. You got to be more aggressive. Don't tell us to just wait one more day. We need it now. And they didn't like his slow, patient approach. He's a very complex man. It's not an easy study. And that's why I would say, that's why I'm claiming all this humility, because I haven't read enough books to really know about what went on during that time. I know I haven't read all the right books. But I know this, he was angry and he handled it in a way that was his attempt at righteous protest that didn't cross over into sin. He wasn't going around punching people. Never read a book about him going around and slandering people, making up lies about people. He simply stood up for what he knew was right. And the way that he got to that peaceful standing up for what was right is because he was angry about sin. So here again is the question for us, the one application for today from this story of Saul and Jabesh-Gilead. What are you angry about? That's not something I ever thought I'd be preaching in this way. I never imagined I'd get up in a pulpit one day and say, what are you angry about? Usually we're all trying to tell everybody, calm down, be peace, love one another. But sometimes we need something to motivate us. We need to be angry about sin. We need to be angry about the enemies of God. Be careful. That's where I think people might misuse it. Be careful in how you try to define who the enemies of God are. Remember when Saul did that in his anger, right? Not King Saul, now I'm talking about the Apostle Saul, right? He thought he was doing something in the name of God when he was persecuting God's people. So be careful how you define the enemies of God, but it's okay to be angry at the fact that there are enemies of God's people. It is, jokingly or serious, however you want to take it, a fruit of the Spirit in this chapter. And then ask, what are you going to do about it? I know that there are some people that have abused this character trait in a very unrighteous way, being angry about things they ought not be angry about, and having a temper and a lack of self-control. And so again, I condemn that as strongly as I can while still saying there are times where the Bible calls for a sharp rebuke. This came up in our Bible class today. I won't drag that man's name into my own sermon here to say that he'd support everything I just said. But in class, he was talking about there are times there are a sharp rebuke. And that is in the letters of Paul, along with our need to love one another. And so what my suggestion for you is the same way that Jesus can be fully man and fully God, and we don't fully understand how all that works out, you can be a loving person and still have anger. And the goal is to channel it in a way that serves the purposes of God's kingdom and not serves the purposes of your own selfish, self-centered approach to life. And so may God help all of us who've listened to this lesson to think carefully about that. Let's go back to Jabesh Gilead. We lose track of them for a while. Their story disappears and it comes back up in chapter 31. So we're going to flip over to 1 Samuel 31. Some of you may already know how it ends. I love this. In 1 Samuel chapter 31, beginning in verse 8. Yeah, for a second I thought I had the wrong one. It came about on the next day when the Philistines came to strip the slain that they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. They cut off his head and stripped off his weapons and sent them throughout the land of the Philistines to carry the good news to the house of their idols and to the people. They put his weapons in the temple of Ashtaroth and they fastened his body to the wall of Bashan. Now when the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead heard what the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men rose and walked all night and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons from the wall of Bashan. And they came to Jabesh and burned them there. And they took their bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree at Jabesh and fasted 7 days. I know that may not be the normal way that we honor a body, but that in this culture, that's what they were doing. They had not forgotten how Saul had rescued them long ago. And so Saul, from that moment of righteous anger that led to, at that time, underneath that covenant, a righteous deliverance. What he did back then is not authorized underneath the new covenant, but under the old covenant, when he was doing what the will of God was for that day and that time and that approach to life, he was honored by the men who had never forgotten what he had done for them. It continues on in 2 Samuel chapter 2. David brought up his men, and the men of Judah came there and anointed David king over the house of Judah, and they told David, saying, it was the men of Jabesh Gilead who buried Saul. And David sent messengers to the men of Jabesh Gilead and said to them, may you be blessed of Yahweh, because you have shown this kindness to Saul your Lord and have buried him. It was not right for the bodies to hang there overnight in that dishonor. And so Jabesh Gilead went to as fast as they could to deliver those bodies to honor. Jabesh-Gilead is an incredible story. I hope it's one that you'll never forget. Not just for the application opportunity there of how will we channel our anger, but it's also a foreshadow of what we know happened with our king. The true son of David, the true king of Israel, Jesus, as he hung on the cross, did he not also have someone who said, the body is not going to hang there? And it was a dangerous and risky mission. Don't take this for granted because we all know this is how the story ends. Just as it was for Jabesh-Gilead, for them to go try to deliver those bodies from the wall, that was a risky mission that they went on. They said, we're going to risk our lives for this man who once fought for us. Well, think about that when you think about the story in Mark chapter 15, when evening had already come because it was the preparation day, that is, the day before the Sabbath. Joseph of Arimathea came, a prominent member of the council who himself was waiting for the kingdom of God, and he gathered up courage and went in before Pilate. We all know how the story ends. We've read it so many times. We just kind of read right through that. He gathered up courage. I'm going to say something here I know the text is not explicit about, but part of why he's going in there is he is angry that his Lord's body is about to be dishonored hanging on the cross. And so in his righteous indignation, he says, I've got to go do something. I can't leave him there hanging. And so he risked his life, his reputation, he risked everything to go in and say, can I bury the body? Pilate wondered if he was dead by this time, and summoning the centurion, he questioned him as to whether he was already dead. And ascertaining this from the centurion, he granted the body to Joseph. And Joseph bought a linen cloth, took him down, and wrapped him in a linen cloth, and laid him in a tomb which had been hewn out in the rock. And he rolled a stone against the entrance of the tomb. Mary Magdalene and Mary, the mother of Joseph, were looking on to see where he was laid. This is an incredible moment that ends up becoming one of the anchor pins in our assuredness about the resurrection of Jesus. This man of prominence no longer cared what anybody else thought about him. He was going to do what was right. And he buried this criminal who was known as a blasphemer in his own tomb, because what he knew was something deeper was going on. This was no criminal. This was no blasphemer. This was not just king of Israel. This was the Son of God. And it was not right what the enemies of God had done to him. So again, I ask you, when will your Jabesh-Gilead moment be? When will your Joseph of Arimathea moment be? What do you need to be angry about in a righteous way, and what are you going to risk to do it? Be angry, but don't sin. And that's the other side of that word that we rarely hear. Would you pray with me? Heavenly Father, we come to you this moment and this morning as we think about your son and all the drama leading up to that moment. And we ask you, Father, to help us draw up courage. Draw up the courage we need and give us the wisdom that we need to be able to be careful as we venture in to the word that we focus on this morning of anger. We know, Father, that so many times throughout Scripture it is something that is wrong, something to be avoided, something that leads us into sin. And we know, Father, that this is a dangerous application. So we ask everyone who's gathered here this morning and those who may be listening online or later on to be careful as we think through this word, not to use it as justification for sin, but to use it as a rallying moment against sin. To be indignant about those who want to destroy your kingdom, about those who hate your love and those who hate your word, those who hate your son. Help us to be angry enough to love them, to love them enough to tell them the truth. And Father, when they turn it back on us and say that they're so disappointed in us because of our beliefs that we have from your son, help us to be okay with their disappointment. Help us to be okay with possibly the loss of a reputation. And in all of this, Father, help us to not sin. But help us to make a stand for what is true, what is right, and what is good. Father, help us to know that in this life we may not get any deliverance, we may not get any rescue from your loved ones. But in the afterlife, we'll be honored for standing up for truth, just as Saul was, by those men who risked their lives to give him a decent burial. Help us, Father, to honor those who've loved us enough to tell us the truth. Help us to honor those who have told us things because they've been righteously indignant at the sin in our life. And even if they passed on, Father, help us to honor them by the way that we live. We pray all these things in your Son's name. Amen.